A pioneer of modern primitives movement, Bakir Muzaffar redefined body modification as a radical form of self-determination. Practices like piercing, branding, corseting, and suspension became powerful expressions of authenticity and defiance, influencing generations of queer BDSM and performance art communities. The documentary A Body to Live In is an exploration of Fakir's expression, resistance, and ritual. The documentary screens June 19th at Frameline 49 at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And we're thrilled to welcome to the show documentary filmmaker Angelo Madsen. Congratulations on your return to Frameline, and thanks for chatting with us today, Angelo.
Thanks, Gary. I'm super happy to talk to you today.
Great. So when did you first become aware of Fakir's work?
I had seen the Modern Primitive Spread, which was the research publication, which was a development that came from like punk zines in the 80s. And I had seen those floating around my sort of scene at the time in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so that was kind of how I first became familiar with the work. And then I got to meet Fakir actually through his partner, Cleo, who I was doing some work with at the time through a mutual friend. And I got to meet him in 2003. Then we sort of stayed in community together for the next few years and got to know each other more closely.
Great. And when did you decide to make the documentary?
Fakir came to see a film of mine at the Roxy, actually, in 2017. And he was super excited about it. And it was actually it's kind of a funny story. It was a queer kind of rom-com, time warp, sci-fi, campy, cult movie. Coming-of-age film about a middle school lunch lady and a student and their unusual kind of proto-erotic relationship and the way it would kind of like exchange through different space-time continuums. And he really loved that film. He said it was like his life's work, which was hilarious to me. But yeah, I mean, it was about love and it was about connection kind of outside of time and outside of body. And so that was something he was really interested in. And I started thinking about, oh, I wonder if there's ever a project to be made with some of his work or some of his ideas. He passed away the next year. And that year I started talking to Cleo about what was going on with the archive, if they were interested in something. And we started talking then. So it wasn't until like end of 2018 that we started talking, and then the research for the film started at the end of 2019.
It seems you've had a wealth of archival material, audio and video recordings, and journals and articles to work with. Talk about the creative process of bringing Fakir's life into cinematic form.
Yeah, the archive is huge, and there's something kind of inherently interesting and idiosyncratic about someone that keeps so much of their history. It's just like kind of mind-blowing. But yeah, I mean, I try to let the images do their own work, you know? So thinking about the things that I'm most interested in and where they overlap with the things that he's most interested in. So like, I'm not interested in making a biopic about somebody that's just about their interests, you know? Like, I'm only interested in making work about the things I'm interested in making work about. And so the things I'm most interested in are the things that get brought to most light in the film. So like, for example, there's tons and tons about his personal life that's not in the film in any way, shape, or form. He had whole other families, whole other careers, none of that's in the film. And again, that's like, just like not my area of expertise or interest. My area of interest is about like building self-mythologies and the way communities organize and gather, the way we sort of like explicate and then try to reintegrate ritual cultures, and how people build out their own kind of systems of belief. Those are kind of the core questions I'm interested in my work. And so those are the kind of the questions that guide the film. And so a lot of the images and archival material I'm pulling from are also materials that kind of support some of those bigger questions. You know, I think like Midori hits the nail on the head in the intro to the film when she kind of asks the question about like an unanswerable question. You know, you're asking a question, I forget what the quote is now. It shows what a good director I am. But, you know, she poses the question that, like, we're looking for something that cannot be answered. And so I like to let that question kind of guide all the choices I'm making visually in the film and leave lots of those questions open for a viewer to sit with. I don't try to explain away why people are doing what they're doing. It's not my place to explain it even. But I hope to kind of just like present it with a lot of kind of humanness, complex humanness, and then allow people to kind of take what they want from that.
I mean, what's remarkable about it, Fakir, is his exploration in this realm started at such an early age, with literally no guidebook. It's just fascinating. He was exploring all these body modification issues, techniques, photographing himself at such an early age, like 14. That's where you sort of begin the film, which is a great idea, because again, here's this mythology. Here is this man who's created himself. At what point did you realize how you would begin the film and how it would progress?
Documentation dating back that far is phenomenal. It's like it's like unimaginable almost, but it exists, so it can be imagined. But like, yeah, the idea of like a fort, like even to think that, okay, so he had to figure out how to build a dark room. You know what I mean? Like dark chemical processing is not an easy process. Like you had to build a dark room. So you were like 13 when you figured out how to build a dark room, and then how to develop and print the photographs, and then how to also do all these practices. Like you have the full product of this work already in place at the time you're 14 years old. That's like, it's like totally trippy.
What point did you realize you wanted to basically move through Fakir's life chronologically and start with that image of him at 14 in that corset?
Yeah, I mean, I always knew the film was going to move chronologically because that made the most sense to me in terms of biography. And also, I wanted to weave in the voices of his co-conspirators and collaborators and friends at the moments in time in which they enter his life. So you'll notice, like, essentially, like, you know, like, Jim Ward's voice really comes in earlier because he was kind of the first person he was collaborating with in that way who I spoke with. So like, you know, and then we like Theo weaves in and out because she's his partner, but we sort of like meet people in the timeline of the film at the point they arrived in his life as well. And so I knew I wanted that to be a sort of structural approach to the film, and, you know, working biographically, like chronology just felt like, okay, how do we keep this? Because this film is already going to be about so many other things. I knew I wanted the film to really be about looking at subculture through the lens of his work. So the film is in some ways not exactly a biopic about Fakir, but it is a portrait of a culture and a landscape through the lens of his artworks. And so because that can feel kind of disparate for a viewer, like I think sticking to a pretty traditional chronology is going to be actually really efficient for this film. I didn't think to start with those exact images. I mean, I had like 18 different, you know, edits to the beginning of the film for a long time. But I'm glad I landed on those because they are just like stunning and striking. And the thing with the archive, of course, is like there's a million stunning and striking photographs. But I think, yeah, just grounding us really in that, how deep that history is right off the get-go is kind of central to settling into this film and allowing it to go some of the places it goes, which are not places we would want to follow in the contemporary moment, you know? But having this awareness of like, okay, this person born in 1930, here we go, really lays a kind of the most kind of directly communicative foundation possible.
So shifting through the archives, did you sort of come across some happy surprises that you uncovered, and what relevance did you find they had to Fakir's story?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know about all of the collection of love letters between him and Annie Sprinkle. And like coming on those was like an amazing moment because I had already wanted her in the film because I knew they had a relationship. And I knew she could speak to some of the ideas well. And also I was really trying to foreground this film within an artistic discourse. So I wanted specifically to speak to people that were of this ilk, but were also understood themselves as artists in some capacity. And yeah, the letters were just unbelievable, amazing, totally riveting, like dozens and dozens of them, just like 6-page typed letters from this lifelong correspondence. And then also like, I feel like I found lots of overlaps in places that I kind of, it's not that I didn't expect them, but it's just that I was thrilled to see them. Yeah, I had I'm like there was like work with Bob Flanagan that Fakir did that was super exciting. There was no footage of it, unfortunately. But there was amazing footage of Ron Athey taking Fakir's workshop in 1992. And that was right when he was developing his really seminal work, Four Scenes in a Harsh Life. And so to understand his work through the context of that kind of environment with Fakir was interesting. So many things.
So Fakir's sexuality was fluid. His life was sort of full of contradictions, maybe not the right word. And your film explores sort of all of these topics and also celebrates him and his life and his work. Were there topics and issues that you decided not to include in the film? You said you sort of shied away or decided to focus on his more of his work rather than his personal life, but you certainly touch on his personal life in a sort of profound way.
I think the things I shied away from were, I think I shied away from certain things because they felt like I would start giving too much information. I feel like most of the things I had to shy away from were in service to the narrative of the film, not because I was shying away from them because I thought they were like too much or something. So like there's lots of there was one early edit of the film where like there was just so many names in the film, people's names being said all the time, because it just felt so important to me to like be able to portray the weaving of this circle of humans, you know, and how Idexa Stern was someone I interviewed, and her name came up all the time with all of the interviewees, and her image comes up in all these archives, and she ended up getting mostly cut from the final film, but like that's just one example of like names of people kept coming up over and over again, and I kept trying to like position them in context, and it just became too much context. And so that was really hard for me to sort of just like strip context, even though I was so excited about context. And you know, there's plenty of images that are like certainly much more graphic than the images I'm choosing to share, and that's of course intentional. To help people enter the work and not push them out. I mean, people are going to self-select with a film like this anyway. Like, people are going to read the synopsis and be like, oh, that's not for me. So I don't have any control over that. And it doesn't really matter what images I choose or don't choose for someone who's going to make a decision like that. But at the same time, for someone who might make a decision that's like, ooh, this might be difficult, but I still feel a little interested, I feel like I'm making those decisions more for that person that, might want to tiptoe in or take a look or see what it's about.
Which is a wide swath of the Frameline audience, you know. People are open to so many things. And as you mentioned, you don't shy away from using photographs and footage that some may find challenging. But you were selective as a person who's sort of just casually familiar with Fakir's work and BDSM and all of these sort of practices, I sort of appreciate that. But the images that you do show really depict what he was about, what his work is about, and still captures the essence of his work and his practices and his life.
Yeah, I was trying to really balance those things and choose the images that were most in service to the sort of ethos of the film, the sort of feeling of the film. Like there's plenty of images of all kinds of like, genital bondage and genital piercing. And I was like, gonna stay away from that. So there's one image that I actually do adore, which is the image of the two inner labia ring piercings that are twisted, and that appears around the conversation about the NEA defunding, actually. And I love that image. I used it intentionally right there to kind of pull in the idea of porn a little bit, because so much of that NEA conversation was about the notion of pornography as a concept, pornography as a threat to culture. And so that's the one point where I do choose to use an image that is a little bit more genitals in your face, even though they're so like art, like so beautifully mm-hmm. artfully. It's like you can't even argue for that to be porn. It's such a gorgeous image. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the way that it's framed that pulls it out of context. So you're looking at Twisted Flesh. You don't actually know what you're looking at unless you know what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. You know? And I like that kind of something is so either so close up that it obscures context or so far away that it obscures context. Those are kind of images that I find really exciting.
Yes, yes. It's such a beautiful film. Congratulations on the film. I don't know if I said that at the start.
Thanks, Gary.
You've been at Frameline before, and you're screening the film at the Roxy Theater?
Yes.
Very good. I know my question is usually, what are you working on now? But usually when I meet filmmakers, they're like, I'm really still working on this film. But is there a project you have in mind for your next?
Yeah, I'm working on a few projects. I work cross media, so I'm working on a performance piece with a former student of mine about mentorship and the complexities therein of queer mentorship and how it gets conflated with grooming and pushing up against some of those taboos. Mm-hmm. And that's a performance piece we're working on. I'm working on a few short films, and I'm working on a few objects also, these print materials.
Very good. Do you have a website where people can see your work?
I do. It's just my name, just angelomadsen.com.
Very good. Well, again, congratulations on being part of Frameline 49. And we'll see you out there on the 19th. The film is A Body to Live In. And we thank Angelo Madsen for joining us today.
Thanks, Gary. Great to talk to you.
Playing with Fire and Ecosexual Emergency will enjoy its world premiere at Frameline 49, June 20th at the Roxy Theater. Filmmakers and Bay Area icons Annie Sprinkle and Beth Stevens explore life and love in the fire danger zone. The sense of alarm can be gleaned from the film's title cards, but even as the emergency sirens go off, the initial ecosexual endeavor, a love story not just between two queers, but between those queers and the planet around them, has not gotten lost. Congratulations on being part of Frameline 49, and thank you for joining me today, Annie and Beth.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Very good. Very good. Are you in Boulder City right now?
I'm in Santa Cruz right now.
Oh, okay.
And this is Annie. I'm the one with the squeaky voice. But I'm in San Francisco. We kind of go back and forth a lot, depending on what we're doing. But it's Boulder Creek, which is in the cleavage of the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Very nice. Very nice. So, Beth, would you like to explain the concept of ecosexuality and why it's become a guiding light, if you will, in your work and life?
Well, ecosexuality is it's an attention-getting sexuality that really means you love the earth. And who doesn't love the earth? It's a very expansive form of sexuality. It, you know, we're lovers with the trees and the skies and the rivers and the mountains. And for the purposes of this film, we're in love with fire. And so it's a way of expanding sex and sexuality, and it's a way of having a reciprocal relationship with our planet and all of its entities.
Annie, talk about what you experienced. We Californians sort of now all have our wildfire horror stories. What did you experience in 2020?
Well, our film Playing with Fire starts out when we were evacuated from the CZU fire and how the social fires also were burning all around us. There was a lot going on. So we started filming. We had already done a film about water and about mountaintop removal coal mining. So this is the third in our trilogy. And just wanted to explore fire, which was what was happening. And the film ends with the LA fires. So it's really an ecosexual emergency, really. I mean, our neighbors were all evacuated for 2 months, and we have a magical white peacock that lives in the mountains in our neighborhood, and we were just so worried about him. and the firefighting goats are in the film. And but you know, is our film talks about trans rights. It has a lot of artists that are exploring fire, and it's a queer take on environmentalism. And honestly, there's virtually no documentaries about environmental issues by queers. There's a new one in Frameline that we're going to go see. But yeah, when Beth made Goodbye Golly Mountain about her home place, there were no environmental docs, features. So yeah, so we now have a trilogy and we're very excited to be in Frameline because we love Frameline and all our cast and crews coming in can see the film.
That's great. So Beth, talk about the Frameline experience. How many times have you and Annie been there, and what does it mean as a queer artist and filmmaker?
Oh, wow. Well, I had a little short in Frameline, just one little short in 1993 or 92, or it could have been 91. It was called Do You Mind? And it was a sexy little short of my old girlfriend undressing a new girlfriend who was all in leather. It was very hot. And I just was so proud to be in Frameline in 1990, whatever it was. You know, it was a really avant-garde film festival. And so, you know, 30 some years have passed since then, and it's still as exciting to be in Frameline. I mean, we basically live in San Francisco, and so it's really nice to, you know, have a hometown premiere, a world premiere, and we can basically walk to this theater if we wanted to. And so we love the Roxy, we love San Francisco, and we love Frameline, and we're just really thrilled to be part of Frameline 49.
That's nice. So Annie, I love, do you think this is sort of a genre that you've created? You've explored these issues in two previous films, and now with Playing with Fire. Do you think other films are coming up? You mentioned the other film that's going to be in Frameline. Trying to remember, Outland,
Rivers
Outlands.
of Grass. Rivers of Grass.
Oh, Rivers of Grass. Oh, right. Okay.
Documentaries. These are documentaries.
Documentaries.
So yeah, I think we are starting to see people like Patagonia, the drag queen, who's doing great environmental work, and just hung that trans flag in Yosemite. Amazing. So we have friends like Reverend Billy in New York, who's and his partner Savitri, the Church of Stop Shopping and the Church of Urthaluja. So we're starting to see a lot of artists doing environmental work that outside the box, outside the mainstream, because we're environmentalists. We adore the earth, and I'm also a sexologist, and care about expanding the definition of sex. I've been doing work about sex for 52 years, and I started out in New York in the sex industry and films. So I've been making films a long time, and I've had four of my own productions and directed movies in Frameline, and I've been in probably 10 or 20 other people's documentaries. In fact, I'm in Madsen's A Body to Live In film. The night before our premiere is this other film I'm in, and I'm on my way to Tribeca for a film I'm in about Ms. Magazine. So I've been on a lot of docs, and I love filmmaking. I had stopped filmmaking, but then Beth got the bug, and we've been partners 23 years. So she infected me again. I had sort of Because it's totally a nonprofit endeavor, labor of love, and it's so much work. And this film, Playing with Fire, we just shot footage for 4 years and didn't know how we'd put it together. It was so challenging. And in the end, thanks to our editor, Diana J. Brody, and working with her, we all put it together in a way we're really excited, and we're getting great feedback from some other colleagues that we've shared the link with. But this will be the first time we show it in front of an audience. So,
Oh, wow.
yeah.
Well, and I just want to say that I want to give a shout out to Keith Wilson too, who's our producer. He really got us focused and, on an editorial pathway, which we, as ecosexuals, we practice circular thinking. And so we were like running around in circles with this film. But we also, Gary, we've written a book. I mean, we have a manifesto. We do performance art. We do walking tours. We do theater pieces. We do visual art. Filmmaking is our, big love right now, but we're very polyamorous. So there are other times when we love a lot of other things. So I just wanted to say that filmmaking is not the only thing we do by any means.
And Beth's a professor also at UC Santa Cruz for 30, what is it? How many years? 30
31.
something. So
Nice.
we hang out with a lot of sex workers, artists, and scholars. It's kind of our community, and we our work's very collaborative. And we joke that we're process oriented because we do so many things. It drives people a little crazy because we don't know what we're gonna do before we do it exactly. And people expect us to know what we're doing, but we have to figure it out along the way, and that's how we roll.
That's half the fun.
Absolutely. That creative process, experimenting and working with people, listening to everyone's ideas, coming up with ideas on the spot, right? That's
Yeah,
what
it's a
creativity is all about.
Well, if let there be peace on earth and let it begin with us, or as I like to say, let there be pleasure on earth and let it begin with us. If we can't get along with our people in our own communities, how's the world, going to get along with, different countries? We can't ex it's not easy collaborating, and we just have to practice.
Yes. I mean, the film is so poignant and meaningful and important, but fun also. Just this exuberance and creativity, and you're not afraid to throw everything out there in such a wonderful way, and explore different aspects of playing with fire.
Can we quote you?
Yes, you may.
Aw, thank you, Gary.
Of course, of course. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I didn't quite know what to expect. It was just immediately drawn in and enthralled. And Albert is adorable. So does he live on your property? Is he just kind of roaming around wild?
Well, he's a neighborhood bird.
He's a neighbor. Okay.
And we found out that we thought he really was our bird and that he was mostly sort of, tethered to our neck of the woods there. But we've come to find out that everyone thinks that Albert is their bird because he just, when he showers his attention on you, you think you're the only humans in the world, right? I mean, it's just so magical. That bird is so magical.
I mean, a white peacock. I've never seen a bird like that. And he's adorable and this cute, expressive face that, you're doing close-ups and it's like he is speaking.
Albert's a performance artist extraordinaire.
And he's 35 years old. He's lived in Boulder Creek and he's a legend in Boulder Creek in the mountains. In fact, the town just unveiled a huge mural of Albert. And yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's terrific. I mean, that's quite a mascot, a white peacock.
We're in love with Albert. We have white peacock ephemera all over the house.
Probably isn't easy to find. I love the footage of him like herding people away from the fire and down. It was adorable. And a gentleman there is talking about him. Oh, we were all worried about him, and here he is working.
A lot of people believe that Albert saved the town of Boulder Creek with his magic.
Don't give it
All
away.
right, I know. Sorry, no spoilers. It's adorable. You've got to see it. You've got to see it.
Thank you.
Yes, of course, of course. I'm sure you're going to have a brilliant audience. I'm really excited. This is the first time you're going to see it with a big audience, huh? Nice, nice. Beth, talk about the idea of embracing fire, despite its sort of devastation, and moving through trauma and fear, wildfire, to a place of acceptance?
Well, there are a few different angles one could, you know, approach that question with. I mean, of course, Indigenous people always worked with fire, and they did prescribed burns, you know, that kept all of the undergrowth quite manageable. And you know, unlike sort of Western forestry practices where you're just grow these trees as fast as you can so you can cut them down and sell them, Indigenous people lived in a more harmonious relationship with the earth. And then we have all embraced fire. Western civilization, from the time of discovering that fire could be used to cook food, you know, to run the combustion engine, to all of the things that we do, you know, foundry work, you know, metal work, all of those things require fire. And we need fire to keep us warm when it's cold. So we have already embraced fire. It's just that we create different categories of good fire and bad fire, right? And I think that with climate change and global warming, I mean, that's another form of fire that's coming at us. And if we try to suppress that, which I think, you know, is or ignore it even, right, it's gonna eat us up. So I think that we have to learn to work with fire and to you know, navigate and improvise with the heat somehow. And I don't really know quite how we're going to do it, but I know that we have to do it.
And I find fire very sensual, even I'd say erotic. And fire smells good. And we actually have a fire fetish scene in the film. And we marry fire actually in the film, symbolically, a ritual with a bunch of friends and colleagues. And we have to you know, appreciate fire. We'd be nothing without fire. I don't know that what would happen without it. But that said, our film is also about social fires. We go to a trans march. We have our breakout star is Brandon, who's a former prison firefighter, and we talk about prison labor, slave labor, really. And how these guys can't, and men and women can't, and everyone that can't get a job when they get out of prison. And we need firefighters, and they're just totally exploited. So we explore these kind of issues while we're also going to a therapist and learning how to, you know, deal with trauma. Because I had a fire earlier, and Beth had a fire earlier at a houseboat in Sausalito that caught on fire and lost pretty much everything. And we interviewed someone who lost everything. So it's multi-layered, like life. It's like, and we filmed my mother's cremation.
Yeah.
Fire, it is complex, and we're not naive about it, but we're also not, you know, it's neither good nor bad. It's everything.
Right. Yeah. And very erotic. You know, you think of making love in front of a fireplace, and it's one of those things you can just stare at, you know, sort of like the ocean and waves. You can, you know, if you sit in front of a fire, you just, it's always changing, right? You'll get these flare ups and you'll get these, you know, cracklings, and you just become hypnotized.
It's beautiful. Fire is exquisitely gorgeous. I'm very visually pleasured. And I could sit by the fire all night for hours. It's very tantric.
And I think Annie is just hot as, I don't know what words you can say on the radio station, but hot.
It is NPR.
hot.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Beth's the Scorpio. She's the real hot.
Oh, no, yeah. And what sign are you, Annie?
Oh, I'm the Leo.
You're the Leo. Uh-oh. Leo and Scorpio. Wow.
Oh, we have some good costumes. I did the costumes.
Great costumes. Oh, I love the silver.
Oh, yes, on the
silver dress and the silver suit.
We did an homage to the film Fire of Love on the green screen with the that's our
I love it. I love it. We won't give it away. You've got to see it to believe it. That segment is so much fun.
Thank you. It's,
sure.
It's a story of two artists in love navigating climate change and with an ecosexual queer gaze, how we want to, play and have fun, because let's face it, the world, a lot of our social structures are burning down right now. And I think our film offers some hope. We've learned a lot about life through fire. There is regrowth, there is the new, it's the cycle of life and death, and then there's rebirth. And we really saw how Big Basin, our state park, burnt, and it's growing again. There's life, there's hope, there's life after death on some level. Maybe not ours, but
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with the film. Again, a wonderful, wonderful film. Everyone should get out there to see it. I hope we'll be able to see it after Frameline streaming or somewhere. So please keep in touch with us and take care.
hey, we will come to festivals.
Very
Thank
good.
you, Gary. Yeah, we actually are going to do a tour to Paradise and Altadena, places that were really affected by fire, and show it to the neighbors there.
Oh, very good. Do you have a website where folks can learn more about where you're going to be in the film, your other films,
Oh
and
yeah, Sprinkle Stevens, STEPHENS.org, like orgasm. Sprinkle Stevens dot orgasm.
Perfect, perfect. Thanks so much. Happy Pride.
Thank you. Happy Pride.